From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The killing and suffering in Syria has been long and deep now, and it's not over. The country's explosive brew of dictatorship, uprising, al-Qaeda intrigue, and chemical weapons in the heart of the Middle East may be about to get more explosive, with implications that stretch very quickly to the United States. This hour on Point, the suffering, the stakes, the ways forward in Syria. You can join the conversation. Where does this go? What should the U.S. do? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The suffering has been intense. Deborah Amos of NPR has been bringing it to us, but lots of people are watching it. Ban Ki-moon spoke at a refugee camp for displaced Syrians in Jordan. The UN Secretary General talked there about the human toll of this now 21-month-long, desperately difficult conflict.
I'm shocked and saddened and even angry at this human tragedy. After 21 months, more than 40,000 people have been killed.
More than 40,000. Think about that number. In this unconfirmed YouTube video from the group Syria Uprising for Freedom and Democracy, shows fighting raging on Saturday in the Sabah Barat area of Aleppo. And speaking to Al Jazeera on Saturday, just to give you a sense of how confusing this all is, a Syrian man in Aleppo, which you heard right there, said this Free Syrian Army, the main opposition rebel force in Syria, had corrupt elements and wasn't serving the people of Syria.
The Free Syrian Army should be restructured and cleansed from bad elements who are working with the regime. They are robbing, kidnapping. This has to stop.
Well, lots of charges and countercharges. Joining us now from Antakya, Turkey, near the Syrian border, is Deborah Amos, Middle East correspondent for the NPR. Her latest trip has had her in and out of Syria with compelling reporting for the last 5 weeks. Deborah Amos, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and it's very good to be with you.
Also with us from Washington is Andrew Tabler, senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, co-founder and former editor-in-chief of the English-language magazine Syria Today, which he produced out of Damascus until 2008. Andrew Tabler, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
Deborah, you're right there on the border. You've been in and out. You brought us such compelling reporting. We're going to look a lot at military and political issues here. But you have made it real for me in a way that much has not in recent weeks. Those red, raw faces of kids in the refugee camps that you describe and much more. Just give us a sense first, Deborah, so we don't brush past the human toll in all this, what that has been like, the killing, the displacement.
I've been going back and forth across the border over the last few weeks. It has gotten easier for journalists to do so. There are three legal crossings where you walk out of Turkey, they stamp your passport, and there you are in Syria. And you can drive to these towns that are close to the border. They are some of the safer places because they are under an unofficial Turkish no-fly zone. The bombings don't happen in these towns. And what you see in all of these places is how difficult it is for normal life. And because there are so many people who are displaced and moving closer to the border because their towns have been bombed. In one place, Jarablus, 21,000 displaced have just landed in this town. I was in a place called Herbet al-Joz. It's a village of 1,4500 people have arrived, and they live in burned out buildings and in schools there. And the local government that actually has organized itself, what they mainly do is hand out humanitarian aid. Same thing in a little town on the other side of the border where you remark about the kids with raw faces.
Yes.
It's the same thing. There are 14,000 people who are sleeping in tents in a place that is cold and wet.
Andrew Tabler, you know this country well, and you've watched as all this has unfolded, 40,000 plus at this point dead. Now, remind us just how that tends to happen. This is not a sort of row-on-row, old-fashioned warfare of any kind. What are the main sources of these fatalities? Is it bombing? Is it the street fighting? Is it the disappeared? How has this number added up so large, Andrew?
It's a combination of different tactics, and the human toll and the cost that that Deb was in, outlining there, and has done such a good job of covering over the last few months of since the beginning of the uprising.
Yes.
What has happened is that the government at first began using snipers and other other, you know, small means to attack protesters, and that would drive up some death tolls. When things began to get out of hand and the opposition began to pick up weapons, when intervention from the outside world did not come, then the regime began using artillery, then combat aircraft, which included helicopters and fixed-wing jets. And despite that, you know, the Free Syrian Army continued to come out and fought the regime. So when you have those kind of heavier weapons used, it drives up death tolls. The regime also tries to move into different areas with its ground forces. That drives up death tolls. And just most importantly, it displaces people because they begin to run. They fear for their lives. They run across the border into Turkey. And now we have just so many that are internally displaced. We're heading into, and we're very much in now, winter in the Middle East. It's going to get worse over the next few months as the conflict continues, the temperatures dip, and rain comes to that part of the Middle East.
Deborah Amos, there in Turkey, when you get stamped across the border to go into Syria to do your reporting there, who's stamping that passport? Is it the Assad government? They're letting reporters come in? And what about the attitudes of the people you see, their mindset, their psychology? Are they numbed at this point in the conflict? Is it that hollow-eyed kind of war-ravaged look you see, or something else, Deborah?
Well, let me take on the border first. Mm-hmm. In all of these places, it is the rebels that control the other side. Some are better at it than others. The longest border crossing open is run by a former cigarette smuggler who became the head of a rebel brigade, and he's pretty good at running the border. He knows how to do it. So he went to the refugee camps, and he recruited school teachers and office workers, people who are pro-revolution, who needed something to do. And so they run a pretty good border operation. They look at your passport. They ask you for a letter from your office. Once they asked me if I could have my letter stamped. I said NPR doesn't have stamps.
Okay.
But they, you know, they have seen what borders look like, and it's a pretty good operation.
But it's rebel run at this point.
It is rebel run in all of these border crossings. They've put up the revolutionary flag. They are draped in revolutionary regalia. They have keychains with revolutionary flags on them. Yes, it's the rebels. There's two kinds of people on the other side of the border. There are many who are those hollow-eyed types that you are talking mm-hmm. about, people who have been driven out of their villages, who've lost family members, who've lost everything, and are squatting near the border. They live in schools, 10 families, 20 families to a room. There's another group of people who are politically minded, and I find in the last couple of weeks, the pace of their activity has really moved in a quite a remarkable way. In fact, in the province of Aleppo, there was an election on December 1st for local representation. The province of Aleppo is promising to have an election very soon.
Is this government run, or is this free Aleppo, or I don't know what you call it?
These are people from the revolution mm-hmm. who want to set up governments. They want a democratic system in Syria, and they're trying very hard to do it. It will not be easy. Most of these towns now are run by the Free Syrian Army. And the piece of tape that you played at the top of the program is a very telling piece of tape. It happened over the weekend. There was a demonstration against the Free Syrian Army in Aleppo. They charged that the rebels there are corrupt. They are not bringing bread into the city. These are people who are hungry. The bread has run out in Syria's largest city, and people are angry at the Free Syrian Army because they have not provided for them.
And this is the face of the uprising. It gets complicated in a hurry. Andrew Tabler, we're reading Jackson Deal in the Washington Post here. He's talking about Syria potentially becoming a second Somalia in the heart of the Middle East, the world's third largest stockpile of chemical weapons, and who knows what hands they'll end up in. A two-sided civil war now breaking down into a free-for-all with Sunnis fighting Kurds and each other and the Alawites of Assad's army there. Al-Qaeda in here, we've just been reading in recent days, but a very effective piece of the rebel fighting force and its Islamist dreams for Syria. You know, who knows what overrunning what I mean, is there a clear set of options for what can unfold here, Andrew, or is anything possible?
I think we can expect anything, and I think in many cases, as I've watched this conflict unfold over the last nearly 2 years, our worst nightmares come true. And of course, it becomes very worrying when you hear warnings coming directly from the White House, talking about the use of, threatening that the use of chemical weapons would lead to an intervention. But the fact is that the international community it does not want to intervene in Syria, despite that very, that nightmarish scenario that you've outlined. We're going to see a lot of, even if the Assad regime goes down, let's say next week, or if it contracts and pulls back and so on, my guess, and based on what I've seen, is I think this conflict will go on in one way, shape, or form for a very long time. It might not involve President Assad. He might, his community might boot him out. He might have to leave. But still, I think the internal conflict between the rump regime, meaning the vestiges of the regime, and the rebels could go on for some time, or there could be a lot of fighting between the rebels themselves after Assad is pushed, down towards Damascus and the coast, and or maybe eventually from power. So, Syria is likely to continue to be a sore issue and a big problem for everyone for the coming years.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Syrian civil war, 40,000 dead, chemical weapon warnings, Al-Qaeda in the mix, rivers of refugees, and huge questions for the U.S. and the region. Deborah Amos of NPR joins us today from Antakya, Turkey, just across the border from Syria. She's been in and out a lot in the last 5 weeks with powerful reporting. It's made the reality there very real for us. Andrew Tabler is with us from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Deborah's been following what's going on in the northwest there, but right around and in the capital city of Damascus, lots of fighting in recent days. And last week in the United States at the National Defense University, President Obama saying that any use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government was a red line not to be crossed. The U.S. would respond.
And today I want to make it absolutely clear to Assad and those under his command, the world is watching. The use of chemical weapons is and would be totally unacceptable. And if you make the tragic mistake of using these weapons, there will be consequences, and you will be held accountable.
Andrew Tabler in Washington, why this warning last week again on chemical weapons? What has brought this to the fore from Washington?
Because there are various intelligence reports that have gone back actually several weeks that outlined the Assad regime contemplating the use of these weapons. Now, that the exact details of that are not clear. But actually, it's something that's been quietly talked about in policy circles for a while. There were reports about the Assad regime mixing some precursors together. And for those of us that have followed this conflict, the Obama, specifically the White House, is so reticent to get involved in Syria and has drug its feet in so many different ways on this conflict. For that message to come out of the White House, to me, indicates that they are really indeed worried and that we are approaching a red line. President Obama outlined that the use or the movement of chemical weapons is a red line for the United States. It would lead to the intervention in Syria. His recent statements, though, have walked that back a bit. It's no longer to move them. It's their use. And so we're seeing a little bit of changing in the wording coming out of Washington here this last week.
Deborah Amos, you've been walking in Syria, talking with Syrians. Are they thinking about chemical weapons, this deadly sarin gas that can come and kill thousands so easily and quickly? Or is that a distant thing from them, something far off in a depot somewhere?
Well, there has been a rebel video, which was a do-it-yourself gas mask with essentially a Dixie cup, some cotton balls, and charcoal. Good luck with that.
Yes.
If this actually happens. A have also been videos of Syrians who say that the regime is using phosphorus bombs in some areas. There's no confirmation that that is happening.
This is the white phosphorus that sticks to people and burns right into them. We saw it used, Israelis used it in Gaza last time, not this most recent, but before. Very, very difficult weapon.
And in Beirut in 1982, mm-hmm. It's been used in the region before, and there has been no independent confirmation that this has happened, but there have been YouTube videos that have emerged with a substance that cannot be put out. Yes, of course they are worried about it, but there is a great psychological game that's going on, it seems to me, from the regime. They are testing what the red lines are. You know, there was a time where it would seem that 40,000 dead would bring some sort of intervention. We are there now. It would seem that using air power against a civilian population would bring intervention. We are there now. And as Andrew rightly pointed out, the language is moving on what the red line is. And it is very possible that the regime is testing the international community on its resolve. Certainly the Western powers and the Arab states that are backing the revolution, are they as committed to their side as the Russians, as the Iranians are committed to Bashar al-Assad's side? And it's very possible that this is a test.
Andrew Tabler, take us to the regime itself then. It has fought back very fiercely in a very bloody way against this uprising. But last week we saw fierce fighting around and in the capital city now of Damascus, attacks on the main airport there in Damascus. What about the durability at this point of Assad's regime itself, which the U.S. has said again and again must go, Assad must go?
The Assad regime, based on, I've made a number of trips to Syrian border regions, mm-hmm. some of the areas that Deb's been in as well, and we've actually spent some time together there, mm-hmm. Assessing this. You can clearly see in the north and the east that the Free Syrian Army is advancing rapidly. They're capturing more bases. They have more weapons now as a result of those capturing those areas. It took them a while because the weapons that were being shipped into Syria, and were few and far between, and any heavy weapons were taken out of the shipments by mostly the United States. So it took them a while, but eventually they've overrun those areas. They now have a lot of more heavy weapons, including shoulder-fired anti-aircraft systems, specifically SA-7s. Mm-hmm. Videos of these weapons have come out in the last few days, and some of them, including al-Qaeda affiliates, including Jabhat al-Nusra, so not good news.
These which can take down aircraft, which is the big
deal. That's right. Mm-hmm. We've seen them down MiGs, we've seen them down helicopters, and now the Assad regime can't use its air power as it did before. So that means that in the north and the east, I expect that the regime's forces are going to have to pull back at a certain point, or will just be forced back. They'll just be defeated. The army will break. The question is then, where would those people then and those forces run to? And I think that's where they would go back to Damascus, to around Homs on the Syrian coast, and try and set up some kind of safe area to weather this storm. And it's at that point that we're going to have multiple Syrias that we're going to have to deal with in the short and perhaps even into the medium term.
Deborah Amos, speak to that, because this area where Syria meets the Mediterranean Sea, just north of Lebanon, just south of where you are, an Alawite stronghold. I mean, it really isn't just necessarily about Assad himself. He represents a Shiite, very, very substantial and powerful group in Syria of lots of people. They won't all go away. What about this idea of a kind of rump state or divided Syria? Do people, the Syrians you talk with, fear that? Do they see that as a real possibility, Deborah?
That has been the failure of the political opposition. They have not found a way to reach out to the Alawites and say in a very clear way, we do not hold the entire community responsible for the crimes of the president and his family. And because that message has been muddied, if you talk to the opposition, of course, they say, oh, yes, we have, but they haven't. And so it is not a big surprise that that for that community, the Alawite community of Syria, they see themselves in an existential battle, that the way that the regime has carried out the attacks against the revolution has so implicated the entire community that they worry about retribution. And certainly Syrian television has repeated that message over and over and over again, that minorities will not find a place in, as the regime describes it, an Islamist state in Syria. They describe that this is what the Free Syrian Army is all about. And so I think that the opposition still has some work to do, even as it's been recognized by France, Italy, Britain, the Gulf states, and we are expecting to see the United States recognize them next week. They have made small steps, but certainly not strides to speak out strongly to this community.
Andrew Tabler, what about it? The regime has said all along, and this is an echo of what we've heard in other Middle Eastern Arab states where leaders come down, you know, take us away and Islamists will take over. Of course, there's a big secular and non-sectarian and non-Islamist drive within this uprising. But as we all know now, and reading just again over the weekend, right at the heart of it, you do have some very tough fighters who are quite Islamist. Al-Qaeda in Iraq tied, in fact, this Jabhat al-Nusra you just mentioned. What are the odds of a post-Assad Damascus being an Islamist, even Al-Qaeda-run Damascus?
I think that in areas of Syria, you'll see Islamist factions being politically prominent. And here I mean by would be those who are affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood or something thereof. Salafists are very strong in other parts of Syria. But I think we have to make a distinction here between those folks and then some of the extremists that that have come on the scene to fight the Assad regime, who are clearly clearly diametrically opposed to the interests of the United States and, you know, and are a really big worry. So I expect that, you know, Deborah was very right when she says that it was a failure of the opposition to reach out to the Alawi community and to sort of debunk this this notion that Syria is going to be taken over by extremists. I think that we're going to see Islamists be prominent in parts of Syria, fall after Assad's fall. And the U.S. is going to have to work with the people throughout Syria in order to help guide this process so that we don't have a hijacking of the revolution by extremists, specifically because a lot of those extremists have a lot of weapons now at their disposal.
Guide sounds kind of antiseptic, but I don't think it will be antiseptic. We've got lots of listeners who want to join us here. William in Watersmeet, Michigan. Thanks for calling, William. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was born in Damascus, and my last visit was in 1989. But looking at the situation, I must thank Deborah Amos for her good reporting.
Yes.
What the U.S. has done so far is acceptable to me because of the elections. We couldn't do anything. We were really paralyzed in that area. We need to start really putting into action a no-fly zone, regardless of what Foreign Secretary of Moscow says and regardless what the noise the Iranians will make. We need to make a no-fly zone, but please, no U.S. troops, no boots on the ground. Just get the MiGs and the Sukhois shut down and paralyze the rockets and the rockets.
So get some American air cover for the uprising. William, let us pick that up if we may. Andrew, thank you. Andrew Tabler, what do you make of that? What would the implications be of U.S. air cover for the uprising, a no-fly zone, American enforced or NATO?
I think that it's something that's been debated to death. I just don't think it's going to happen. President Obama does not want to intervene in Syria unless he has to. And absolutely, there has never been a question about boots on the ground. The only scenario in which that would happen, I think, is in some cases the use of chemical weapons, were involved in securing those weapons, that might be involved, you know, that might include some special forces, some ground troops. But there are a number of courses of action which have been outlined in the U.S. government and think tank circles, some of which have been extremely passive, including the use of Patriot missiles to do so. The Obama administration has said no to all of them. So I don't expect it's going to happen. And I think that, you know, the videos coming out of Syria in the last 2 weeks, and some of whom were by extremists, they actually said, we're going to set up our own no-fly zone with these SA-7s that they've captured.
Shoulder-fired missiles that can take down aircraft. We're going to dig on in on that. Let me get a call from Samir in Belmont, Massachusetts. Samir, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You asked a question earlier on whether or not Islamists will take over, and I'm of the opinion that they will definitely take over the country, and that would not be a good thing for the country.
Why do you think it will go their way in the end? Why?
Because the war they're fighting is an impossible war for President Assad to defeat. It's a war that the greatest countries in the world could not stand against, and by that I mean even the U.S. could not stand in Vietnam against such a rebel fighting.
But Samir, let's say Assad goes. Why should the government that remains behind be Islamist? Not all of those who opposed Assad are Islamist, of course.
I am from the region, as you may have been able to tell from my accent, and I know there is a lot of people who are waiting for the opportunity, people who would belong to the Muslim Brotherhood, and they have been waiting for the opportunity to remove Bashar Assad, who is an Alawite, for a long, long time. And unfortunately, the opportunity came under the title the Arabic Spring, which is neither a spring nor is it Arabic, I think.
Samir, let us pick it up, if I may. And Deborah, I want to come to you, but I'm going to lose Andrew in just a minute here, so let me get his thoughts on this. Andrew Tabler, what about it? You know, Samir sees an Islamist takeover. This is what the Assad regime has warned of, but the uprising is not only Islamist. What are the odds and what are the implications if it's a significant portion of Syrian territory and control goes to the extreme elements of the rebellion?
I think that there are so many different formations in the Free Syrian Army that I think it would be hard for one faction to completely take over. That's one. I do think that that the post-Assad Syria, especially in the near term, is going to be a struggle between the armed groups, which are there, who I think will be calling the shots, and the civilians upon which they're going to rely to help rebuild the country. And Deborah outlined some of those efforts, and so it's going to be a real mix. Where I think Islamists, mainline Islamists particularly, have an advantage and could have an advantage, and if we can see that elsewhere in the region, is that they're better at organizing and they're more disciplined oftentimes. So that's actually not a strong point usually of the liberal secular forces. But maybe in the case of Syria, because they've been forced to deal with things that are happening on the ground, maybe the civilians will come together and form something more secular. I do expect that Islamists will be prominent in specifically in the northwestern part of the country, but I don't know how much their penetration into society in eastern Syria, where tribes are prominent, you know, will they be able to overshadow those tribes which have existed there for hundreds of years? I doubt it. So I think we're going to see a real mosaic, different types of forces at work in Syria after Assad pulls back and eventually gives way.
Mosaic is a word that can cover a lot of eventualities. Andrew Tabler at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you very much for joining us today, Andrew.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Syrian civil war, 40,000 dead, chemical weapon warnings, Al-Qaeda in the mix there, rivers of refugees, big, big questions for the U.S. and the region. NPR's Deborah Amos joins us this hour from Antakya, Turkey, right on the Syrian border, which she has crossed many times in the last 4 or 5 weeks, bringing powerful reporting back from Syria there. She's author of Eclipse of the Sunnis. Deborah Amos, we were just talking with Andrew Tabler about the the odds of a major Islamist, even Al-Qaeda, influence on the other side, let's say, of an Assad regime collapse or pullback. He's talking about the Northwest, where you are, being a potential stronghold for that, not far from there anyway. What are you hearing from Syrians about that concern or, for all I know, ambition?
I hear a lot of worry about the radical Islamists here. I also hear a lot of support for them because they have been the most effective fighting force on the battlefield. They are the guys who know how to take over a military base. They are always the second brigade that goes with another. And so they have proved themselves as terrific fighters. And as a Syrian watching this unfold, we're now in a second year. What you want is it to be over. And so they have gained popularity because they're good fighters. They have also figured out how to do a little bit of public relations. In the town of Binish, they are giving out free bread and cooking gas, which is almost impossible to get. They've done the same in the big city of Aleppo in the neighborhoods that they control because the flour is running out in Aleppo. There is a local council. It's called the Revolutionary Transitional Council. These are people who are trying to run Aleppo post-regime and now. They are in a race with al-Nusra Front to deliver flour to Aleppo to get credit for that with the civilians, to play the same public relations game, to be responsible government people, to bring basic services to Syria. I think what we are seeing is a fight over identity. I agree with Andrew that there are going to be places in Syria, some in the villages in the northeast and the northwest that are more Islamist than others. But whether al-Nusra Front runs anything seems unlikely to me. These groups don't care about running governments. They have a magical caliphate that they want to set up, but they have never offered a plan on how to do that. So when the day comes when the regime contracts and falls or however this endgame plays out, and the people who are trying to set up local governments, when that kicks in, let's see what happens with these radical Islamist groups.
Deborah, talk to us about this Nusra Front, the Jabhat al-Nusra. This is a direct offshoot of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which Americans know well from lots of heavy resistance there, many casualties, Iraqi and American, at the hands of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And, you know, they're both arming and directly fighting in this Syrian civil war, as I understand. I mean, many have come right from Iraq. Is that right? And what is the relationship between al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Nusra Front in Syria?
Certainly, ideology is what they do share. And there have been some who have come from Iraq. They have also recruited Syrians here. And part of their appeal, of course, is they are well-armed and well-funded from private donors in the Gulf. So if you are a young man and you want to fight with the best fighting unit in the country, they have a certain appeal. They are ultra-religious. No one can smoke in their camps. They don't take everybody. You have to share their ideology, which, you know, there's not a great test. So if you're a smart guy and that's who you want to fight with, you can get in. They are somewhere around 6,000 to 10,000 members, somewhere around 10% of the fighting force. The reason they have gotten so much attention is because they have been successful. For example, today there is a fight over a place called Sheikh Suleiman Base. It's a large, sprawling military base west of Aleppo. If that base falls to the rebels, that means that they will have a clear swath of territory between the west of the city all the way to the Turkish border. The force that is fighting there is al-Nusra Front. And so if that base falls, when that base falls, because they have about half of it now, and those weapons then are available to pick up war booty for the rebels, it'll be al-Nusra Front that gets them. Well, and over time, they have been amassing arms.
Let me ask you then, Deborah, they're effective. They're good fighters. They'd like to see this big caliphate, Islamist caliphate, established across the region. It least in theory, and I'm sure more than that. They are also, of course, Sunni. And here you've got Syria right next door to Iraq. This is a direct offshoot of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. If Assad falls and group like this is empowered in that fall, could Syria turn into a Sunni base for civil war in Iraq, where the Shiite government, you know, brought to power in no small part by the United States, is now in power? Could we see cross-border war here?
There are certainly concerns about that, and certainly concerns in Baghdad as they watch this war unfold. And if Bashar al-Assad falls, there is every reason to believe that this will be a Sunni-dominated government. The question is, how Islamist will it be? Nusra Front, as is al-Qaeda in Iraq, is not known to take and hold towns. That did not happen in Iraq. In fact, they went dormant for a while as the Iraqis themselves turned against these extremists. When it came down to normal life, they were not terribly happy with these extremists. And they have sort of come back to life with this fight and this chaos going on in Syria. There will come a moment, for example, in the city of Aleppo, when what people are going to be interested in is turning on the lights, bringing in the bread, having the schools reopen, having the 200 factories that are in the free zone in Syria operational again. The business community wants to come back. They won't come back if al-Nusra Front is a large part of how that city operates. And I think the activists, the politicians, the Free Syrian Army all understand that. That's why I say I think we have to wait to see what happens when the regime falls. And there will be different dynamics that will be unleashed among the population.
Deborah Amos on the Turkey-Syria border with us today. Mahmoud's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Mahmoud, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for calling, for receiving my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just have one comment about the President Obama talk about the using of the chemical weapons. The only way Syrian people see this is they are allowing the regime to kill the Syrian people when they use the tanks and when they use, but when they slaughter them, but they are not allowed to use the chemical weapons. This is a very cruel way to deal with the humanitarian and the people there in Syria who are currently dying from lack of food, lack of medicine, and lack of power and electricity. And everybody is just waiting for something to be happened to finish their misery.
So yeah. why draw the red line at chemical weapons when tanks and all kinds of aircraft, strafing and bombing have been used to kill Syrians? Deborah, what do you say to our caller Mahmoud in New Orleans? You know, why this red line? Why chemical weapons?
Well, it is hard to argue. People are still dead, and they die in artillery strikes, and they die from airstrikes, and he's absolutely right. People are dying because the bread is running out. People are dying because it's cold, and people are dying because they're under shelling. But it has been very clear since the beginning of this conflict that the United States does not want to get involved in any way militarily in Syria. It is a complex country. It is a key and strategic country in the region. And the United States has two wars on its hands. This administration has gone out of its way to extricate the United States from Iraq and then Afghanistan. And so you have seen policy since this began to stay out of this particular conflict. Chemical weapons raises red flags because of the implications of not just the regime using them, but falling into the hands of extremists who are here. And so you see that became the red line. But I agree with the caller that Syrians are dying in appalling numbers.
I mean, we're talking here about mustard gas, VX gases, deadly sarin gas. With all the chaos and the many different forces at work, how on earth is anybody going to keep track of all those chemical weapons if we eventually come to a kind of meltdown here of Syria, Deborah? Well, I mean, what are the odds of those not going astray, as Washington would see it?
At the moment, it seems to me that the administration does have some idea where those weapons are. If you watched how the story unfolded, it began with leaks in the New York Times from security officials in Washington that they had information that there was some either mixing of chemicals or moving of chemicals. My reading of the way the story unfolded is that was a message sending to Bashar al-Assad and his regime. We know. We have intelligence. We saw what you did. Yes, you did turn off the internet and all cell phone coverage for 3 days, but we still saw what you did. And if it didn't work, that the New York Times published it, we'll tell some other newspapers. We'll leak the story around. And so my sense is that there is information about where those stockpiles are, who controls them, what the chain of command is in the country. And there have been two stories in the last week that imply that there is a team being trained to go across the border if Assad uses those weapons.
Do you mean a U.S. team? And across what border?
You know, I can't confirm any of these stories, but they are floating out there, and they essentially say that there are Syrians who are being trained to cross the border into Syria to secure those weapons. I think Bashar al-Assad knows that too. Any movement of these chemicals, any use of these chemicals, he has to think long and hard. Yes, it is true the Obama administration has moved a bit back from where the red line is, but you can see that most Western governments have spoken very strongly about this, and there are reports that the Russians have, which is an ally of Bashar al-Assad, have also spoken to him about no use of chemical weapons.
Let's go to Tiffin, Iowa, and Carla. Carla, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Deborah Amos.
Thank you, Tom. I'm just wondering if the U.S. does little, if nothing, to help send in weapons, and apparently is doing nothing to help these starving, freezing refugees, why would it expect to control or even influence the aftermath when Assad is gone?
Carla, let us pick it up. Deborah, I'm not sure that exactly lines up with what you've been reporting, but what do you say to Carla's question?
Carla, that is a very smart observation, and it is exactly what policymakers are beginning to think about now as we move towards what may be the end phase of the Bashar al-Assad regime because they have been so passive in that in their policies that they won't have a way to guide what is happening here. Yes, there are training classes for some of the activists here for communications and democracy building and capacity building. And yes, it is true that the United States has put some $200 million into caring for refugees, but their profile has been almost invisible to most Syrians who believe that the Americans have done nothing to help them. That honor falls to the French. They have been very good at being outspoken about their support. They were the first to recognize the Syrian opposition. They were the first to send a diplomat over the border with cash for villages that needed a bakery so people could survive. The Americans are only now beginning to raise their profile, allowing stories to be done on the kind of U.S. aid that is going into the country. But most Syrians don't see it.
Carla, thanks very much for your call. One more, Ruth in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Ruth, you're on the air with Deborah.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to know where the economic fallout comes from us sending in any kind of aid, whether it's military or humanitarian. Who gets to pay for that? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Who would pay for it? I mean, I guess everybody would pay for it. And Americans very keenly focused on fiscal issues right now, and of course, everything comes with a price tag. But the events have a price tag too. I mean, what's the downside that has Washington worried here, Deborah?
The downside is that they have not been able to predict how this conflict will unfold over time. I think that their calculation was the rebels would not be able to take down the regime militarily. And as time has gone on, the rebels have proved them wrong. Over time, they have also not predicted that the rebel force has become radicalized by events on the ground. I often explain when I meet young men who have grown their beards and seem more religious, you know, we Americans have a phrase that is, there's no atheists in foxholes. Yeah. And I think that happens often with Syrians, that if you see your colleagues, your pals, your the guys that you play dominoes with, you know, going through college, dying, you tend to get a little closer to your maker if you think you might be next. I think that will have to shake out after this is over. But all along, every worst scenario that has been predicted by analysts has now come true in Syria.
Maybe costs in more than one direction. Big meeting coming up in Marrakesh. You say you expect the U.S. to recognize what, the Syrian National Coalition as the government of the country?
As the legitimate representative of the Syrian people. They have not selected a government yet, and we will see what happens when they do.
Lots in motion here. Deborah Amos, your reporting has really opened our eyes, and we're grateful for it and for your time today from Antakya on the Syrian-Turkish border. Deborah, be safe, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today, to you as well. You can continue this conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.